Welcome to Technovation, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, president of Meta Strategy, advisor to technology executives, Forbes columnist, book author, and your host. Each episode of Technovation features insights from top executives and thought leaders at the intersection of business, technology, and innovation. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please subscribe so you don't miss a thing. Thank you. My guest this week is Stuart Russell. Stuart is a distinguished artificial intelligence researcher, a professor of computer science at the University of California, Berkeley, an adjunct professor of neurological surgery at the University of California, San Francisco, and leads the Center for Human-Compatible Artificial Intelligence at UC Berkeley. Along with Peter Norvig, Stuart is the author of Artificial Intelligence, A Modern Approach, the most widely used textbook on AI. In his most recent book, Human-Compatible, AI and the Problem of Control, Stuart proposes a fundamentally new approach to developing AI. In this interview, Stuart warns that AI is reshaping society in unintended ways. As an example, he notes social media content selection algorithms that choose what individuals watch and read don't even know that human beings exist. As AI becomes more capable, he suggests that we are going to see bigger failures unless we change the way we think about AI altogether. Stuart argues that to ensure AI is provably beneficial for human beings, we must design machines to be inherently uncertain about human preferences. This way, we can ensure they are humble, altruistic, and committed to pursuing our objectives even as they set their own goals. We also discuss why AI needs regulations similar to civil engineering and medicine, the impact AI is going to make over the next decade, the topic of autonomous vehicles, and a variety of other topics.
Stuart Russell, welcome to Technovation. It's great to speak with you today.
Nice to be here.
Great. Well, Stuart, you are the professor of computer science, or a computer professor of computer science at the University of California, Berkeley, an adjunct professor of neurological surgery at the University of California, San Francisco. You also founded and lead the Center for Human-Compatible Artificial Intelligence at UC Berkeley as well, written a number of books, perhaps most notably along with Peter Norvig, Artificial Intelligence, A Modern Approach, and then most recently, without co-author, Human-Compatible Artificial Intelligence and the Problem of Control. Clearly, you're very steeped in topics of AI, and I'm looking forward to covering your journey professionally as well as your writing. But I thought we'd begin with a quick step back to understand a bit about what drew you originally to the field of artificial intelligence.
So I first became aware of the field in the mid-70s when I got a Sinclair Cambridge programmable calculator. And I'd always been curious about how intelligence works, how the human mind works. And finally, I had in my hand a tool that I could use to explore that question by writing intelligent programs. But the calculator had a capacity for a 36-keystroke program, so that wasn't enough to do much artificial intelligence. So I got permission to go to Imperial College and use their giant CDC 6600 supercomputer. So I wrote a chess program. So that was how I got hooked on AI. But I was, you know, my real career at that time was intending to be a physicist, which is what I studied as an undergraduate. But then the lure of AI just drew me. So I did my PhD at Stanford, and I've been at Berkeley ever since.
And your PhD was in 1986, which I offer by means of context. You know, the field of AI obviously goes back much further than that. It has gone through various peaks and troughs in terms of development and optimism. There have been a confluence of factors that have come together in recent years that have really powered a lot of the revolution that's happening of late. But I wonder if you could talk a bit about sort of where things, from your perspective, where we stand now in the overall evolution of artificial intelligence. I recognize a rather large question to ask you, but given the sweep of history which you've participated in, wondering sort of how you could typify sort of where we stand at the moment.
So, as you mentioned, there have been some ups and downs. And when I finished my PhD in 86, that was during one of the ups. That was the expert systems revolution, where AI was going out into the real world. People were building expert systems, which were essentially collections of rules for reasoning about particular kinds of problems, whether it was medical diagnosis or, you know, how to configure a supercomputer or something like that. So thousands of those systems were built, but many of them turned out just not to work very well in practice. The more you added rules to them, the more they started to make mistakes. That led by the late 80s to what we called the AI winter, and interest waned. And my AI course was down to 25 students at one point. It's back up to 900 students right now. So we're in the middle of another enormous explosion of interest, of excitement, and investment, just as we were in the mid-80s. The technology itself, so separate from the level of interest in Silicon Valley and in the media, technology itself doesn't go in booms and busts. Basically, it gradually accumulates as we solve more problems and develop better theories, and we improve the ones we have. Our capabilities increase basically monotonically. There are periods where they accelerate faster, and this is one of those because of the development of something called deep learning, which is a method of training large tunable circuits from data so that those circuits do a good job of tasks like speech recognition, recognizing objects in images, machine translation, and so on. And machine learning is a technology that has been around since the 1950s. And again, we've gradually increased the size and scope of the kinds of data that we can handle. It used to be, for example, that training with images was just infeasible because the volume of data was typically too big to even handle on an ordinary computer. But because of advances in hardware, we were able to start training larger circuits with larger amounts of data, many more images. And we saw, beginning around 2012, a rapid improvement in the ability of these systems to recognize objects in images and other tasks. So that's what's happening right now, and that's stimulated an enormous quantity of investment, many, many startups, and many interesting applications like self-driving cars.
You mentioned one of the most prominent of the innovations that have arisen in recent years as a result of artificial intelligence's progress. I wonder if you could take a moment and talk about, as you look to the sort of near future, or maybe the medium term, those areas that you think are going to have the most profound impact, either for consumers or for enterprises, as the case may be.
So I think we're already seeing very significant impact. And the thing that's coming down the pipe that's going to be most obvious to everybody is a self-driving car, which will, you know, revolutionize a $1 trillion industry. It will hopefully make everyone a lot safer on the road. It'll provide mobility to many people who don't have it right now. It'll reduce traffic jams, probably reshape our cities, many of which devote large areas to parking. And so you'll be able to walk down streets without having to navigate parked cars, climbing up on the sidewalk, and all the rest of it. So things like that will be very obvious to people. There's also a lot of stuff that's just invisible. We get used to it very quickly. It wasn't that long ago that search engines didn't exist. And search engines are actually artificial intelligence algorithms that are running constantly, scanning the web, finding new material, and then integrating it into a model of what you're going to be interested in. And then when your query comes along, the system tries to figure out what's the most likely response that it should send that you're going to be interested in. So that's a very complicated and large AI system running all the time and being used by literally billions of people every day. I think in the next decade, in the 2020s, we should see real progress on understanding language so that the system will not just be able to recognize what you're saying to your phone, for example, or your little home assistant device, but we'll actually be able to understand it and have a conversation with you and learn about you and your life to such an extent that it'll become a really useful assistant. So it'll be like having an expensive personal assistant who, you know, typically these days works for a politician or a CEO. But instead of costing you $100,000 a year, it'll cost you 99 cents a year. And that, I think, will, again, be very obvious to people that AI is now part of their lives. They'll be interacting with it every day, and it'll be really essential to managing their daily life. And similar kinds of personal assistants helping you with finance, with health. Education is another big area. So once you have the ability to understand language, which means you can have a conversation, then the AI tutoring systems, which up to now have been basically mute, in other words, you can't ask them a question. They can spit out pre-digested material to help you learn something, but you can't ask them the question. So that's going to change. And we'll have AI tutoring systems that can, you know, bring students up to a high level of understanding and competence much faster than a typical classroom could do. So these are areas where there'll be very significant impact on daily life, and all for the good. And then further down the road, if we look into the middle distance, we start to see that these capabilities, the capability to understand language, other skills such as being able to construct plans, being able to integrate the input of many visual sensors all over the world so that the system gains a real idea of how the physical world works. When you start to put all these capabilities together, then you get into it, the idea of general purpose AI, systems that are not just capable of solving a particular task that they're programmed for, but they're actually able to cope with the whole range of things that human beings can do.
And how far do you feel like we are from that reality? I know that it's difficult to answer that definitively, but given the progress we've made, how far do you think it is in the future till we realize that?
Yeah, so as you say, it's difficult to predict because it's not a quantitative problem. It's not as if we just need bigger machines or more data. You know, a bigger machine just gets you the wrong answer more quickly. So that's not the solution. We actually need some real conceptual breakthroughs. So real understanding of language currently eludes computers. They're sort of like parrots. They kind of recognize variants of things that they already know how to respond to, but in terms of really, for example, being able to take a physics book and read it and then go away and design a radio telescope, they're nowhere close to that level. So a conceptual breakthrough is needed, I think, for real understanding of language, for long-range planning in the real world, for the kind of cumulative discovery processes that we see in science. Machines are not able to do this right now, and each of these requires one or more conceptual breakthroughs, and those are very hard to predict. But having said that, you know, given the level of investment happening now, which is really unprecedented, we will probably see some of those breakthroughs happening within the next decade. And most AI researchers believe that sometime around the middle of the century, we will have something that looks like general purpose AI.
Well, your latest book, which I mentioned previously, Human Compatible Artificial Intelligence and the Problem of Control, you note there that there is a problem of control that we need to grapple with, that the machines, as they become more intelligent than we are, that they may draw their own conclusions that counter what we believe to be beneficial. And you go on to note that machines are intelligent to the extent that their actions can be expected to achieve their objectives. And also, machines are beneficial to the extent that their actions can be expected to achieve our objectives. You go on in your book to to note that we need to be able to prove AIs, or rather form AI in a fashion that is provably beneficial for humans. And I wonder if you can talk a bit about that idea.
Yeah, so let me unpack this a bit. The standard model for AI is the first version that you mentioned, where a machine is intelligent to the extent that its actions can be expected to achieve its objectives. And this was a notion that we basically copied back in the 1940s, 50s from our conception of human intelligence. So this idea of rational behavior, of actions that achieve objectives, it goes back thousands of years, and it was gradually made more precise and mathematical in philosophy and economics over the 18th, 19th, 20th centuries. And that was the notion that we basically copied when we were looking around for a practical definition of machine intelligence. So despite what you might read in the media that AI is about passing the Turing test, which is about, you know, intelligence as being a direct copy of human intellectual activity, that's actually not what we've pursued in AI. No one within the field makes serious efforts to pass a Turing test. Instead, what we've done is we've tried to instantiate this more mathematical definition of intelligence as rational behavior, actions that achieve objectives. And that's fine as long as the machine is relatively stupid and is confined to the lab, or better still, even, you know, confined to a small virtual world like a virtual chessboard or a virtual Go board, because things go wrong when you specify the objective incorrectly. So this is not a new notion, right? You know, the legend of King Midas shows you exactly what happens when you get what you ask for. So he asked for everything that he touched should turn to gold, and he got exactly what he asked for. And then, of course, his food and his drink and his family all turned to gold, and he dies in misery and starvation. So this idea, you know, the saying with the genie in the lamp, he gives you three wishes. Your third wish is, please undo the first two wishes because I just ruined everything. you know, that notion is in pretty much every human culture. We understand this. And the problem with the standard model of AI, as I described, is that we cannot specify the objectives completely and correctly. So when the machine is stupid and when it's in the lab and when it's doing something with very limited scope of impact on the real world, you can set the objective, see how it behaves, and then you realize, oh, you know, I forgot something important. And then you might go back and revise the objective, and then press the reset button and try again. You know, one of my favorite examples of that is in simulated evolution. So this is where people make little simulated environments where creatures can evolve. They have a simulated genetic code, and you supply a fitness function which decides which creatures get to reproduce. And the designers wanted to see if they could evolve creatures that could run really fast. So they said, okay, the fitness function is going to be how fast can you move your center of gravity? And the simulated environment would, you know, let the creatures grow up, and then it would calculate how fast they moved, and then it would make more of the ones that were moving faster. So what evolved actually was not creatures that could run fast, but creatures that grew enormously tall. So imagine 100 miles tall in this simulated environment, and then just fall over. And in falling over, they moved really fast. So they won the evolutionary race, and it wasn't what the designers intended at all, but it was the solution to the problem that they set. So that's, you know, amusing, and it's a simulated environment, so no one got killed by these falling trees. But when you get out into the real world, for example, when you look at what's happened with the social media content selection algorithms that choose what you read, they choose what you watch, those algorithms are learning algorithms that optimize a fixed objective, which turns out to be click-through or eyeball time or some other monetization metric. And in doing that, they have had enormous collateral damage on the real world. So this is an early warning that this type of model, creating intelligent systems that optimize a fixed objective, can be extremely dangerous when the algorithms operate in the real world on a global scale. And right now, the social media algorithms are very, very simple. They don't even know that human beings exist. But as AI gets more and more capable, we're going to see, I think, bigger and bigger failures of this kind unless we change the way we think about AI altogether.
Yeah, very interesting. And so you noted that we need to ensure that it's provably beneficial to humans. What's the method of doing so?
So if we accept the premise that it's not possible for us to specify the objective completely and correctly, then you don't want machines pursuing the objective that we put into them. At best, they should understand that objective as an incomplete and possibly erroneous attempt to communicate what human beings really want. So the machine has to operate in the knowledge that it does not know what the true objective is. And this is the radical break with the standard way of doing things in AI. We have always assumed that the machine has the correct objective. And that's a mistake. And interestingly, you know, for the last 40 years or so, we've understood perfectly well that the machine is not going to have correct knowledge of, you know, the physics of the world, for example. It may have some partial knowledge, may be able to make sort of weak probabilistic predictions about how things are going to turn out, like is it going to rain tomorrow? But we know that machines cannot exactly predict the weather. They cannot exactly predict how humans are going to behave. And so they have to deal with partial uncertain knowledge of the world. But for some reason, we forgot that the same applies to the objective. They are not going to know exactly what the objective is. So when you change the way the whole notion of intelligence is defined so that the machine knows that it doesn't know what our true preferences and objectives are, then you get a very different kind of behavior. The goal is, it's still in some sense the same. The goal is to satisfy our preferences about how the future should unfold. But if the machine knows that it doesn't know what those preferences are, then, for example, if it comes up with a plan that messes with some part of the world and that it's not sure how it should mess with it, doesn't know whether we'd be happy with that or unhappy with that, then it has an incentive to ask us, because obviously it wants to make the right choice and not the wrong choice, but it needs more information from us in order to do that. So you get machines that ask permission, machines that allow themselves to be switched off because they don't want to do whatever it is that would cause us to switch them off. And so they're happy if we decide to switch them off, because that way they avoided some catastrophic outcome. And none of these things are possible for a machine that believes it has the correct objective. And in the language of economics, we call this a game theoretic formulation. So game theory studies how to make correct decisions when there's more than one decision-making entity in the world. So they use that to study, you know, warfare, bidding in auctions, all kinds of real-world problems. And here, what we're saying is, in fact, there's a decision problem, not just for the machine alone, but in fact, it's in a coupled system with the human being, because it's trying to help the human, but the human is the one who has more information about what helping means, about what the real objective is. So the machine is going to solve this two-entity, or in general, many-entity game. And the solutions to the game produce these behaviors that we think of as deferential, asking permission, allowing yourself to be switched off, and so on. but they fall out not because we program them in, but because they are the solution to the game, to this mathematical problem that we set up for the machine to solve. So that's the sense in which they're provably beneficial, that you can show that when the machine solves these games, the results are beneficial to the human. Now, to get that mathematical theorem, you have to make a few assumptions about the human, such as that the human is a rational participant in this game. And of course, that's, shall we say, an approximation. Humans are not perfectly rational, and they deviate from rationality in many, many interesting ways. So one of the big parts of our research agenda is to figure out how to accommodate human imperfection in the way the machine interprets our behavior.
Very, very interesting. And I mean, as you note, there humans have imperfections, and we're not perfectly rational, as you note. There are, not all humans also are good actors as well. Thankfully, many more are good than are bad. But what do you see as the role of the government and broader regulatory forces to ensure that what you're describing comes to pass? Because, of course, as you describe this reality and the pathway towards ensuring that AI is provably beneficial, as we noted before, it's not as though everyone will necessarily be compelled to follow the recipe you've described.
That's correct. So I think, you know, two things have to happen. One is we need to develop all of the technology on this new foundation, because we've had 70 years of developing technology on the old foundation, and some of it's pretty useful. And people aren't going to give it up and then wait another decade for the new version to arrive. So we actually have to develop the algorithms for the various different kinds of decision-making scenarios that that people need, you know, including different kinds of machine learning algorithms, as well as planning algorithms, reinforcement learning for the kind of algorithms that robots use to learn how to behave in the physical world. So all of these things have to be rebuilt from scratch in some way. Now, when we've done that, we'll basically have templates for each category of AI application, saying, if you conform to this template, then you have some guarantee of safety. You have some guarantee that you will be able to switch off the machine if it's misbehaving. You have some guarantee that the machine won't be interfering with parts of the world that you don't want it to be interfering with. So at that point, then it would make sense to start setting up standards through the standards organizations and regulations, because when you start to have systems that are potentially more intelligent than human beings, there is a serious downside. This is not like, oh, well, someone might, you know, be driving their self-driving car and have a crash, right? So it's not sort of onesies and twosies kinds of accidents. It would be potentially, you know, as has already happened with social media, it will be big negative effects on a global scale. So we don't currently allow scientists to experiment with making disease organisms more contagious and then releasing them into the environment to see what happens. We don't do that. We don't allow people to develop nuclear weapons in their physics labs, except, you know, in the national labs under very, very strict conditions. And so it's not unreasonable that there should be legal regulations on the types of AI systems that can be deployed. I mean, if you think right now we have a problem with malware, with cybercrime, and sometimes viruses, you know, computer viruses that get released that actually have much worse, more widespread global effects than even their evil creators intended. This would be far worse than that. So I think people will have to accept that when you create powerful technology, it's reasonable that there be constraints to protect society from it. And so we'll have regulations saying you have to have basically provable conformity with these templates. And there is a technology called proof carrying code, which I think will turn out to be really useful. So proof carrying code means a program that comes along with a proof that the program does what it's supposed to do. So even if you don't understand the program, and even if you don't understand the proof, you can have another program that checks the proof against the program that's supposed to be behaving properly and verifies that, in fact, yes, this program is going to do what it says because the proof shows that it does and the proof agrees with what the program is saying. So that kind of technology can be used to say, okay, here's a piece of AI software, you know, coming from some Russian software company. I can check if it comes as proof-carrying code that it actually is going to conform to the standards and behave itself. I mean, it may not be useful, but at least it's going to behave itself. So just as we have App Store rules that say your app cannot run in the App Store, cannot be sold, unless it conforms to all these software checks so that it doesn't cause your phone to seize up or it doesn't steal data from other apps and so on. So we like that, except for any piece of software that's sold or connected to the internet would have to pass these checks.
And are you optimistic that accomplishing this provable conformity, that we'll be able to provably accomplish provable conformity as you've described?
Yes, I think we can do that. It's part of a gradual maturing of the whole IT industry. In other areas like civil engineering, where people build bridges and skyscrapers that people's lives depend on, they've developed over the centuries both codes of conduct and, you know, there are literal legal building codes that say you cannot build buildings that don't have these properties. And that's perfectly normal. We don't think about that as onerous government regulation. We're pretty glad that, you know, when we're on the 72nd floor of a skyscraper, that skyscraper conforms to the building codes. So the IT industry is going to have to start becoming more like civil engineering, more like medicine, where people have a mature acceptance that the lives and well-being of humans are in their hands, and they take that responsibility seriously. And I don't think the IT industry has quite gotten around to this idea that they have a serious effect on the world, and not necessarily a good one.
Well, Stuart Russell, thank you so much for joining us on Technovation this morning and describing your own relationship with AI, its progress, your vision for the future. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in. This Wednesday, we will have the first of what we hope will be many bonus episodes this year. It's a debate on blockchain. MetaStrategy's Stephen Norton led a discussion at our MetaStrategy Summit in 2019 on blockchain between Ed McLaughlin, the president of operations and technology at MasterCard, and Neil Sample, who went from chief information officer to chief operating officer at Express Scripts. He now carries the chief information officer title at Northwestern Mutual, but has a much broader purview than the typical CIO. Ed offers the perspectives of a blockchain optimist. Neil offers the perspectives of a blockchain pessimist. We hope you'll tune in to listen.